Anyway, coming here to the conclusion, I've kind of hinted all the way through that this has a strong connection with love and compassion. And indeed, the last section of His Holiness's book that I've been following that structure is called Absorbing. I think it's called Absorbing Yourself in Ultimate Love. And not being one to want to second guess His Holiness, but thinking that these things are probably presented by editors. I've kind of retitled it in my own mind, Being Absorbed by Ultimate Love. So it's up to you, but that seemed to me to be more agreeable to my sensibilities anyway. This is a nice Tibetan saying at the beginning that he quotes. It says, "It's not sufficient that the doctrine be great, the person must have a great attitude." So the kind of proposition is, as you probably already guessed, is that knowledge of the emptiness of inherent existence, and it's knowledge, not just intellectual knowledge, but you could amplify by saying knowledge deep in experiential understanding, direct sight, insight into it, it makes the most, it's what, in many senses, you could say, makes the most profound level of love and compassion possible. Whether you see that possibility being realized by cultivation or just by realizing the absence of inherent existence, the true nature being exposed, as it were, allows the unimpeded compassion to flow. So, but either way, Chandrakirti, Indian, famous, very famous Indian Buddhist philosopher, said, "I offer homage to loving concern, viewing transmigrators, i.e., people who go from life to life, as empty of inherent existence, though they appear to exist inherently, like a reflection of the moon in water." And going back to our images and illusions, the reflection of the moon in clear, calm water appears to be the moon in every aspect, but the moon's actually in the sky. The moon analogies and images in the tradition, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, abound. And one of the images I always rather liked is it's an image which is trying to show how we are deceived by the illusion of inherent existence. And they say, well, it's as crazy as people sneaking up on the lake at night with a net to fish the moon out of the water. That's really rather lovely. Really rather lovely. So the image kind of symbolizes, it's used as a symbol there, as the appearance of the eye and all other phenomena kind of inherently existing in their own right, wholly independent from their own side, but actually being completely empty of that way of existing. So, like someone mistaking the reflection of the moon for the moon, we mistake the appearance of the eye and all other phenomena for things that exist in their own right. So you can use this and other kind of symbolic poetic metaphors and analogies to develop insight into how we're drawn into suffering by assenting to false appearances, falling prey to attachment and aversion, which at their most extreme become expressed as greed and hatred, but there's a continuum there. Some of it's very subtle and maybe apparently harmless, but the attachments and aversion in the end start giving rise to more extreme expressions of greed and hatred. And then we accumulate karma, i.e., have to experience the consequences of our actions. And the mistaken belief in the reified I existing in a way that it doesn't kind of strengthens, and the cycle of pain continues over and over again, whether you think of that from a cosmological many lives perspectives or the cycles of our own behaviour in one lifetime. Our experience. Yeah, which itself has no inherent existing nature. Yeah. The moon is not singular, permanent, partless, existing from its own side. It's the same for all. So it is an analogy, it's a poetic illusion. We exist, yeah? Here we are, we exist. Alive, vibrant. That's the moon. The way we see ourselves as this hard, solidly, inherently existing from its own side, not dependent on anything else, persona, is the reflection of the moon in the water. It's like that. And also, some people, partly because of the nature of the language, if you're really not of a philosophical disposition, or maybe at a point in your life where philosophy is not of interest, then a way to work is with images, symbols, metaphors. You can feel your way into it, yeah? If you've got some understanding of how it works, you can work that way, you know. Poesis is as possible as gnosis, yeah? But you need a little bit of gnosis. But, you know, if you don't want to work that way, there's another way to work. On the other hand, if you're very interested in, or, you know, philosophy kind of works for you, then you can use that too, or you might be very fortunate and use both. I mean, I'm a little like that, so academically I'm a philosopher by training, but I've always loved literature and loved poetry. So I kind of alternate between the two, it depends on my mood. So sometimes one appeals more than the other, or I can get clarity with the philosophy, but I can get a real feel for it. And also the use of the symbols, poetic metaphors and analogies reminds me that all these things are fingers pointing at the moon. The tendency with the use of the philosophical language is that you think you're going to end up with some final description of it and that will be it. But it's not coming from there. The philosophy is just training you to get to the experience. It's not as if there's some formula of words that any of us could put together that would say, aha, at last. That one doesn't exist really, I don't think. Happy to argue the case if anybody wants to. So there it is. We can use those symbols and metaphors to develop insight into how we're drawn by suffering into assenting to false appearances, falling prey to attachment and aversion, which as I said becomes at its most extreme form greed and hatred, and accumulating karma, that actual really solidified sense of I becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, and the cycle of pain continues over and over again. And that's whether you either have knowledge of, think there might be, or couldn't care less about former lives, it actually, that cycle's going on right here, right now. So at every level, you can see that. So we're all sentient beings suffering in a cycle of behaviour, and Tsongkhapa and Chandrakirti, I think Tsongkhapa may have borrowed it from Chandrakirti, kind of likened this to a water wheel. The water wheel's got buckets fixed on it, and the water pours down, and so the buckets go round and round, picking up the water, and they go, and there's nothing, they're driven by the water all the time. So it's saying that in that cycle of behaviour, we're driven round and round and round like that, unable to get off, driven by the forces of past action. And like a bucket on a water wheel is the analogy, driven by the consequences of our actions, imbued with momentary impermanence. You know, we're moment by moment impermanent. And we ourselves are like the shimmering reflection of the moon in the water, under the power of ignorance, habitually going along with and taken in by false appearances or the illusion of inherent existence. So with that experiential insight, sort of front of and fresh in the mind, great love and compassion for all sentient beings can spontaneously arise, because we're all in the same boat. In this sense, we're all the same. Nobody's any different. All sentient life forms want pleasure, don't want pain. And in one way or another, in the grip of the same illusion. So you feel close to them. You're the same as them in wanting pleasure and happiness and not wanting pain. And they want happiness rather than suffering, just as we do. So to access the depth of love and compassion, it's necessary to understand that both you and all sentient beings are empty of inherent existence. All our kind of, the proposition here is that all our destructive and problematic emotions derive from or are dependent on ignorance that doesn't know or understand how we, others, and everything that appears actually exists. You know, right back to the beginning of the week when we were talking about avidya or ignorance. What is it? You know, it's not bad manners. It's not having been to school or any of that. It's right there in the Sanskrit and the Pali and in the original teaching as mistaking things for having a more solid, concrete existence, singular, permanent, partless, existing from their own side than they actually do, by not being dependent. So it doesn't know or understand how we and others and everything that appears to us actually exists, how they actually are. So again, we actively assent to an illusion and misconstrue their nature. So by directly realizing the way things are in reality, empty of that perceived inherent existence, we can liberate ourselves from the cycle of pain that drives us and help others much more effectively. So, as I said, sort of remember, go back to where we started. Although there are many factors in the cycle of painful behaviours, the origin, the root of it, second noble truth, the root of suffering, is ignorance, avidya, actively assenting to the illusion of inherent existence, mistaking it for the way things actually are. It can be severed. That's the second noble truth. You know, we can uproot it and bring about the end of the destructive emotions that arise and depend upon it. So it requires kind of repeated study, observation, that phenomenological approach, reflection and meditation in a quite free environment. You know, it's in an open way. It's not about accepting a doctrine or saying, oh, I like the idea of emptiness, I'm a Buddhist, I believe in that. No. What is it? What does it mean to you? Is it real? Is it true? Is what's being said? Does it actually stack up? Is it philosophically sound? Does the logic hold up? Does it match with experience? So on and so on and so on. So it requires study, observation, reflection and meditation. But if we go down that route, we can internalize the process so that it's no longer something intellectual, but it actually comes from the depths of our being, from the depths of our hearts, if you like. Yeah, and that's the one that will actually bring about a realization of emptiness. And then it's possible to generate an intention to achieve liberation, because you have to get out. You have to get off the wheel. You know what I mean? At that level, there's no thinking about it. It's in order to be a benefit to all sentient beings with more than just words. Yeah. And I kind of noticed that because it was made easier by deciding to rely on a text and have a structure. But of course, thinking it wants a structure, I can't leave it to chance. I sort of started typing out a skeleton and a structure. And then I was thinking on the train up, well, how to flesh it out. And then every day I'd tweak it a bit. I'd think in the evening about what had gone in the day and what had gone in the morning, and then do it again, and then do it again. And then the machine tells me I've now got a document of 10,702 words. You've all probably read a bit in the course of the week, and nobody's counted the chatter, yeah? Well, unless at least a fraction of that turns into practice, unless it gets done, you know, that's where it stays. Armchair Buddhism. Nice idea. Yeah? So I think if we're going to have a takeaway from this, is has any of that 10,702 plus words done anything to make us motivate and think about, can I leave the retreat and take that with me and sustain the practice? Yeah, and sustain the practice. So whatever practice you have, this, if you frame it as emptiness yoga, may not be a main practice. Or it may be, you may like it enough to want to make it a main. But if not, can a dose of emptiness go into the practice? You know, can a dose of emptiness inform our wandering about in everyday life? If so, then it's been really worthwhile coming. So the proposition in terms of becoming absorbed in ultimate love is that by this method we can become spiritual practitioners of whatever path we follow, of greatly increased and indeed potentially limitless capacity. So we also, and so do people in other spiritual paths, if you like, train in and practice ethics, you know, ethical conduct, to enable us to control and limit the grosser manifestations of destructive and damaging selfish afflictive emotions, harsh physical and verbal behaviours that harm both ourselves and others, is important. Yeah, it's one of the three higher trainings in all of the Buddhist paths right back to the Pali Canon. But however, the ethical practice alone is a sticking plaster. Yeah, it can't completely eradicate the afflictive emotions. The application of antidotes is extremely useful, especially at the beginning, in the middle, and towards the end, if you see what I mean. But all that's doing is controlling the worst excesses, yeah, maybe even a little bit of suppression there. So at the end of the day, you might be really, really good at it and be of great benefit to yourself and others, so let's not knock it. But you're never going to actually eliminate the source, yeah, and realise liberation working with antidotes alone. Although it's helpful, it's not enough. It's only the insight and wisdom, realising the emptiness of inherent existence, in Rob Bevere's, I don't have the book here, in his book title, The Seeing That Frees. Yeah, The Seeing That Frees. That's the only thing that's going to finally put an end to the origin of suffering and allow us to become absorbed in ultimate love. By the last chapter of His Holiness structure here, is absorbing yourself in ultimate love. Think in what the Buddha taught, wisdom and compassion are inseparable. They're two conceptual isolates of one reality. Wisdom and compassion, or they're like the two wings of a bird. It's like, I suppose, down, and that sort of works at many, many levels. So down at one level, if we come down to the conventional level, some people are intellectually very, very astute, and they're very, very clear, very, very sharp. So on the wisdom side, they're very, very strong. And it's a bit like the question we had about bereavement. So if you just bring wisdom to that, then you say to the bereaved person, Oh, well, they didn't really exist in the way you thought they did anyway, and come out with all these philosophical arguments. And although the person meant well, strong on the wisdom side, we can all see that it would actually be inappropriate and really unkind. Yeah. Because there's something missing on the compassion, empathy, skillful means, seeing what human beings need, understanding that from the heart. Yeah. So the wisdom makes it possible to see that we don't exist inherently in the way that we do, yes? And if you take this beyond the intellectual wisdom side insight, then this can dissolve and the heart can open and have, it's like the form of refuge I offered at the beginning. You know, there's refuge in the Dharmakaya, emptiness itself, shunyata. And then there's the clear, lucid nature of that experienced. And then in the human form, the Nimanakaya, it's possible that unimpeded love and compassion will flow. So the illusory idea of the inherently existing self dissolves, the heart opens, and it's absorbed in ultimate or universal love.
So that is when...
Or either it opens, or we realise that it's always been open, either way. Yeah. But what it means is the illusory, self-centred, self-cherishing I becomes absorbed in ultimate love, compassion. Love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, if you go back to the four Brahma Viharas. Yeah? Is that helpful or not? Well, where I go then, have you had an experience where, I don't know, maybe you're looking outside and you see a bird, and then the bird is sitting in a hedgerow, and a sparrowhawk suddenly dives and skewers it, or the bird falls on the floor, or it's out of the nest, and you know that it's going to die. Is there a natural kind of a feeling for that?
Yeah.
That's the one. That's the one. Quite without any thought, quite without, you know, it's that one. So think about that one, reflect on that one. It's actually a very natural human response, empathy. Mm-hmm. But it's working not at an intellectual level,
yes,
but at,
yeah.
Compassion.
Yes, yeah. But what I'm saying is the extent to which we are no longer in the power of the illusory, inherently existing I, to the extent that we're no longer under the power of that, more of this is possible. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to go there because it puts too many kind of too much intellectual stuff on it, mm. And you say, oh, you know, then all the metaphysical speculation starts. But absorbing yourself in ultimate love, yeah. Be a way of saying love is, maybe the universe is love, yeah? But then I don't want to get into all the metaphysics of that, but what I can do is connect it with these feelings and the way we are, because most of us seem to be able to find them for one another and other sentient beings. I mean, when we find people who really can't, it's a medical issue, and we know that it's unusual.
What does it mean in that they don't understand human emotions, or they've got no empathy?
Yeah, like for example, it's where we go to try and understand psychopathy, isn't it? But there was one I read this morning in the news. I thought I'd take a little peek of the news, it being the last day of the retreat. And there was a wonderful story of a Catholic nun in Singapore who decided to. That she would make it her work to befriend people, and especially women, that were going to be executed for crimes they committed, because in Singapore they still have the death sentence and use it regularly, if you see what I mean. And it was a story of her work, really, but she spoke about one person, and she always had, however, whatever she did with them, she actually walked to the gallows with them, held their hand, you know, and all of that. And of course she was talking about the people who she'd worked with, who'd done some pretty awful things. But of course she was saying, of course they're more than that. And she said, everybody is worth more than they've done, no matter how terrible it is. She's got it. We're not defined by any of that, however awful. Person's still a human being. Yeah? Anyway. Pretty worth investigating, but to our point, this is it, the absorption of the illusory self in ultimate love, which is always there if we can give up the illusion. And it's like the nun in Singapore. I mean, it also made me think, well, I know it's a bit of an iconic one and much overdone, but Adolf Hitler died in a bunker with Eva Braun and two children. You could say they committed suicide and murdered two children. But I've no doubt that the two children loved Mum and Dad. And Mum loved Dad, and Dad loved Mum. Yeah? And that doesn't mean I suddenly say, oh, Adolf, you're forgiven the huge mess, an unbelievable amount of suffering that you drove in the world over 4, 5, 6 years or whatever. It doesn't make that any better or worse, but it's worth remembering that never deprived him of his humanity or his existence as a sentient being, you know. Anyway, continuum is a continuum.
Yeah.
The earlier moment of consciousness brings around the present one that brings about the future one, and that just keeps going.
Yeah.
Yeah, but good, I think, as I've said before, much as I love metaphysical speculation, the longer I go on, the more austere I get about it. Because otherwise I see people going round and round and round. None of it quite works. And then, worse still, they grip onto it and start trying to reify it. And give it an, oh, well, it must inherently exist this way or that way. Frankly, I have no idea. And having spent a lifetime toying with what you might call constructive metaphysics, I'm much more into deconstruction and not going down the rabbit hole of trying to come up with an explanation that reifies my idea of what that might be, but more to have an experiential understanding. Maybe other people can work a different way, because for all I know, some people may have memory of past lives or have visionary or yogic experiences which gives them insight into the future. You know, unfortunately, I am terribly ordinary and have had none of those experiences. So, but I have had a lot of experience from a philosophical point of view of being trained as a philosopher and then as a Buddhist practitioner. And in a way, I love it when people go off on one, on a big speculative one. But then I think, oh, no, they're already trying to reify it and say, well, it must be this way, and then argue with someone else who says, no, it's like this. Mm. And I'm thinking, well, at the end of the day, it's a shibboleth.
Yeah.
You know, it's just going to go...
Yeah.
Like the distinction in the two truths between ultimate and relative. Yeah, when we told the idea of the ultimate truth and relative truth, so you've got the conventional reality, it all looks like this, feels like this, appears like this, but ultimately none of it exists in the way that it appears. It's empty of inherent existence, and that's the ultimate reality. So ultimate love would be ultimate in that sense, so that conventional love, you know, beautiful though it is very often bound up with in believing in my own inherent existence, the inherent existence of the thing or the person that I love, and beautiful though it is, and all of that, if it's founded on that, that's ultimately going to come to grief, and I'm going to be bereft when the person's gone, or really upset if they stop loving me, or similarly if the thing I love disappears or I can't have it or whatever, and pain and suffering results. So the absorption of the illusory self in ultimate love means in a love that is unconditional, limitless, unbounded, not describable, yeah, ineffable, not limited in any of the concepts, conventional ways. Yeah.
And any other kind of
yeah. A short break until 11 o'clock and then come back and do the second session.